That's what it's called, late Victorian Holocaust, El Nino famines. Anyway, so the relief measure was that if you are living in a famine zone, if you want to qualify for relief, in order to separate the able-bodied from the or the malingerers from the truly famine stuff, you had to walk a distance of a minimum of 10 miles to get any work. Those who could make it were obviously not famine struck, so they could be put to work. The people who couldn't make it and collapsed qualified for relief. Now, obviously, this was kind of, you know, fairly tough love for people who were starving to death. So this didn't prove very popular. And this was seen as another sign of soft subjects under imperial rule. The laborers, for instance, this article goes, who had already learned how easy it was to shrink their task upon the civil agency works, at first objected to the stricter discipline and low pay of the better controlled undertakings, and particularly to what was called the distance test, which consisted in refusing employment to them close to home. There were not wanting intriguers and pseudo-philanthropists there, you know, these people always are the root of any trouble, who persuaded ignorant coolies that if they should strike work, petition, and give enough trouble, the old system would be forced upon the government again. Crucially, the soft government argument was often extended to suggest that any welfare measures undertaken by the government were inimical to the long-term fiscal health of the colony. Gerlofsen, for example, outlined the risk of a welfarist approach. If the government is too precipitate in proffering help and a favorable change of season ensues, the policy which has inclined the people to abandon their habits of self-reliance is deprecated. And if the signs are too evident to be mistaken, government in providing food and labor must take care not to clash with the mercantile community. That's the kind of bottom line for any welfarist measures. You cannot take care, you must take care not to clash with the mercantile community. This appeared to be an oft-repeated Victorian mantra. No government, it was held, especially a colonial or imperial one, should be allowed to lapse into welfare measures that contradicted the fundamental principles of extracting profit and labor. Indeed, some of the heaviest criticism, this is by British writers about the British colonial government, were reserved for government relief works that were seen to lead to drastic impoverishment. Writing about the post-famine Bengal in 1877, the Edinburgh Review, for instance, chastised the British government for precisely this. This wholesale mode of relief, welfare measures, has resulted in a loss of revenue of at least 8.5 million sterling, while there has been an impoverishment of the presidency of Bengal, from which it has as yet by no means recovered. British colonial and imperial governmental failures stemming from causes other than benevolence could be admitted. This was another strand. We got it wrong before, but we have improved now. Could be admitted as long as it was always already in the past and helped to underwrite a narrative of constant progress. Baird Smith, for instance, was candid about the deadly confluence of the atmospheric and economic forces that caused the famines of 1837-8, and this is the famine that Emily Eden found herself in. Drought coinciding with the most, this is Baird Smith talking about 1837, but writing in 1866, coinciding with the most vital administrative act which ever influenced the material conditions of native society, the tax assessment, or the fiscal system as he calls it, was thoroughly bad. This is a British administration he's criticizing, but it's already in the past. It can never happen again, he says. The assessments were excessive, unequal, and unintelligent. Great discontent was naturally created by these blind and summary proceedings among those whose interest had been neglected. Writing in 1861, Baird Smith saw this excessive taxation as a thing of the past, a mistake that had been corrected by the progressive imperial government after the mutiny of 1857. Similarly, writing in 1868, Gerdelston could candidly present the notorious Warren Hastings confession about the great Bengal famine nearly a century ago. He quotes Hastings, I have reason to fear that the cause existed principally, note the principally here, he's not talking about nature, he's talking about principally in a defective, if not a corrupt and oppressive administration. The thing is, he's talking about his own administration here. Both the writers and numerous others were confident that a clean break had been made with this imperial corruption, oppression, and inefficiency. And Victorian India enjoyed the blessings of a progressive, modern, and humane government. Yet there were those who voiced the discomforting idea that misgovernance, far from being a thing of the past, was precise a path that modernity had erased, in fact, lay at the core of the Victorian imperial system. And these were British writers. W.G. Pedder, for instance, writing on the connection between famine and debt in India, pointed out that at the heart of empire lay the continuing structural exploitation of the Indian peasants. Taking a random sample of 600 North Indian peasants, he found that they were liable for 16 times their assessed rent and more than 1.5 times their gross annual produce. Moreover, he says, it appears that during the last 15 years, including a period of unexampled agricultural prosperity and following immediately on the change of government, which was to bring in a new and happier era for India, debt has increased more than sevenfold, while the proportion of peasants free from debt has fallen from 3/5 to 1/8. In other words, we're just talking about a perpetually and chronically indebted and immiserated society. In the Statistical Society's debate following Cornelius Walford's epic survey of global famines, an Indian from Calcutta, Abul Fazl Abdul Rahman, quite an interesting figure, he ends up in London participating, and as far as I can see, shouting down anything that the Statistical Society provided, saying, you're all wrong, I'm from India, I know better, etc. Disputed the cozy consensus that it was the backward nature of the Indian peasants that made them refuse to undertake public work, such as digging a canal and government. Instead, he pointed out the chronic indebtedness of the peasant that was made worse during and after the famine by fresh taxation that were laid on to recover the cost of governmental charity. Digby, again, writing about the rise in food prices and southern Indian famines, discovered that both the capitalist market mechanism and the railways, twin icons of Victorian modernity, were directly implicated in creating famine conditions. He says the rise in prices was so extraordinary that merchants and dealers, hopeful of enormous future gains, appeared determined to hold their stocks. It was apparent to the government that the facilities for moving grain by rail were rapidly raising prices everywhere, and the activity of apparent importation and of railway transit did not indicate any addition to the food stock of the presidency. In other words, again, railways and the market spread famine, not food. That's what really is the message of